Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Today, Nirvana, Kurt Cobain, negative feedback, negative criticism, and the nature of artistic freedom. On the Nick Oliveri Show, I'm your host, Nick Oliveri. Ukrainian-born, best-selling novelist. Did a book tour all throughout 2024. And man, I am tired in 2025 and want to do a little less traveling, although there will be spots to hit soon enough. Now, today, let's get right into it. Thank you for coming on, hopping on, joining. I just really, really appreciate it. This isn't necessarily a passion project. It's not business. It's another way for me to express myself. Now, I want to start this episode off with actually some negative feedback I got on my last two episodes, mainly my two episodes ago, episode one, literally, of the show. I'm already getting some backlash. Because I spoke about Onyx Storm and I had some criticism for it, and I think I'm seeing it in the algorithm and the numbers, and I think the machine, hey, call me a conspiracy theorist, but if more powerful people and wealthy people want me to shut up about being negative over Onyx Storm, then I probably will get downgraded in the algos, the almighty algos. That's just how it goes. Anyways, I was critical of Onyx Storm, and not just Onyx Storm, because I was very vocal and explicit. I've never read that book by Rebecca Yarros. I've never read it. I was mainly critical about the apparatus around which it was sold. Okay. And I got negative criticism about that. I was even called, I was told by someone I came off as a disgruntled, like an old disgruntled, by the way, I'm 24 at the time of recording this, an old disgruntled novelist who's jealous of someone else's success. I'm not that. I was told a bunch of other things. I was made fun of on multiple platforms and in person. That's okay. Sometimes you give what you get. I know, like, there will be really corny, like, Facebook posts that your mom, like, reposts, or like, or you see on, like, Instagram reels to some really corny acoustic music in the background of a sunset, and it says, in life, you give what you get. You're just gonna get what you give. Sometimes a little later. Sometimes you get what you give. And it gets paid back to you in interest. But interest takes a while in all this crap. That's not actually always how the world works. Study nature. Read a couple pages of a history book. Maybe just one page of a history book. You don't always get what you give. There are takers in this world. There are bad deals. There are the world is not full of reciprocity. The world is not full of balance. People aren't balanced. Yes, you're not balanced. Nor am I, but that should be clear by now. Especially if you've taken a walk through my literature, you can follow me on Amazon in the link below. And I'm going to continue to promote that. I have multiple. And we just got some new bracelets for the Idaza fashion line. Gold laced 18 karat bracelets with Idazan scriptures, artisanally made. Very exciting. That was a tangent. But anyways, so I gave some negativity out there in the world, and I got some negativity back. Some people would say, you get what you give. You get what you give. Not the case, but in this case, I did get some reciprocated negativity, we could say. And my answer is no, I'm not a disgruntled author who is jealous of someone else's greater success in terms of commercial success. In fact, there are a lot of critics that liked The Conjurer, my debut, a lot more than, what was it, her 18th or 19th book ever published, which was Something Wing, or something like that. But I'm not here on this podcast doing these episodes and talking my you-know-what to tout my accomplishments and to toot my own horn. I'm just not going to do that. I'm not here for that. But I know who I am. I know what I'm worth. And on some days and some weeks when I don't, I figure it out. And sometimes it's a journey to learning what you're worth, and you continue to go on and go on and go on. But ultimately, I love me some me. I like what I've done. I love what I've done, and I love what I do. So there's nothing disgruntled about it. And if you take a look at the last two episodes, it was a fairly calculated diatribe of the traditional publishing industry and the apparatus that surrounds a book like Onyx Storm with the spectacle. I don't like how it was distributed and produced. I don't like the craze. Now, granted, I'm, of course, a very biased individual. I myself am a hypocrite, in that everyone is biased, yes, but I'm going to go ahead and admit my own biases. I am a natural-born contrarian. I don't know why. I don't know where that came from. I ever since the cradle, ever since the womb, I've been saying no when people say yes. I've been zigging when people zag, and that's just how it goes. So you can take that for what you want, but at least hear my words clearly and explicitly. And if you're going to leave feedback, you know, kind of like how I didn't comment on the contents of Onyx Storm because I didn't read it. I just told you what I'm assuming is in it. And then in the second episode, I told you what I read about the reviews of what's in it. And then my presumptions after no research were affirmed. Wow, would you look at that? Maybe I do know a thing or two about publishing. Maybe I have been doing this for some years now. Maybe. Either way, this is not a channel for negativity. This is not a podcast for negativity, and I'm not only going to give criticism. In fact, that's kind of rare. It just happened. It's just so happened that I started this right around the time of Onyx Storm, and I in this craze and these midnight lines wrapping around the corner, starting at 4 a.m. in the wee hours of twilight and dawn, just for this one book that I'm sure they'll be able to buy a week from now. It's very impressive. I wish Rebecca Yaros, if that is how you pronounce it, the most success. And her family and her friends, I hope it continues to go well for her, in a way. So, no, this channel isn't just going to be me giving diatribes to other authors. I'm not going to go all Edgar Allan Poe on you folks. And when I do critique more books, like, if I'm ever reviewing a book and I really don't like it, I'm going to give you the reasons as to why I don't like it. If I've read it and I'll, you know, when you read it, you are technically studying the contents of it. Of course, I have my own unique perspective as a self-proclaimed prose stylist. I love how things are said. I'm not always as interested in what's said. I haven't read Onyx Storm. There's a very slight chance I do. Probably won't. Very slight chance I do. We'll see. Anyways, let's get to the main topic of this episode. I wanted to talk about it. It's been on my mind for a while. I am like a dilettante historian, or just like someone who loves history and all types of history. I'm someone who loves art and all types of art, and that includes, you know, music and paintings. Obviously, I love literature. Obviously, I love philosophy and diving deep into the themes of literature and film and things like that. But I love biographies, and I love what they can say. And they could be as recent as people who are still living, current memoirs. But usually I like more historical figures. Unfortunately, this is now an historical figure. His name is Kurt Cobain. You may be familiar with him. He was the frontman for Nirvana. Here's where we get into this episode's meat and potatoes, which is artistic freedom. I want to go over a scenario. So if you don't know Nirvana, how do I describe him? very, 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 very big in the early 90s. Dave Grohl, ever heard of him? Kurt Cobain, long blonde hair. Ever heard of him? Always had that like like 5 o'clock shadow, but it never like really grew that much, and it never really like got clean shaven. I don't know what was up with that. Maybe he just had a great trimmer. I don't know. But it was part of the image. Courtney Love, I'm just trying to tell you things. You know, early 90s. 93 was in Nevermind came out. Album cover with the naked baby on it. Swimming and Reaching for the Dollar. That is, of course, attached to the fish hook. This is all being seemingly photographed in a pool or in a body of water of some sort. And the baby's like really happy and reaching for the money. It might be like a sign that like, oh, from cradle to grave, we are taught to, you know, chase money. And then the money's a trap because, you know, the fish hook metaphor. But anyways, that's an album I absolutely love. I know that's not a very hot take. I love Nevermind by Nirvana. There are no skips on that album. When you listen to that, you put on the album, you put on track one, and you go. And there's something to be said in every line. There's always something being said, even when there are spaces in Kurt Cobain's lyrics. So Kurt Cobain was a frontman. That's if you don't know who Nirvana was or is. They were, oh, and by the way, they were a grunge band. Didn't even tell you. musicians. And it was kind of a reaction, and a guttural, visceral reaction, the grunge movement. Now I'm really being like a pseudo historian here because I'm not super well versed in late 20th century pop music and pop rock. But what was really popular in the 70s and 80s, one genre was like kind of this version of glam rock and pop, but a lot of glam rock and a lot of, if you've ever heard hair bands and synthesizers were like not just coming out, but coming to the forefront of music. And then people began to overdo it with the synthesizers. Like, have you ever, when you were younger, did you ever get something for Christmas or Hanukkah or birthday, whatever, but like when you were a kid, I'm talking, and you got this present, and maybe you only got like three big presents, or just three presents in general, and this one just captured your attention, and that was like all you. Maybe it was a video game, maybe it was a dollhouse, maybe it was a toy truck, maybe it was a book, a movie, whatever, Lego set, and for the next week or 2 weeks, that's like all you did. So you like overcorrected the cadence and flow of your life based on that like one new gift. That was essentially the synthesizer in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Not so much the 60s, but 70s and 80s. And that brought about a lot of the glam rock, which grunge music was in effect a reaction to it. Look at history. It really is just a pendulum swinging back and forth. And you can find that in microcosmic situations, and you can find that on the largest scale of civilization possible. It is a giant pendulum, larger than any of us can see or even fathom, and it goes back and forth in small ways and in big ones. Grunge music was supposed to be the rebellious, the means of taking back this power, this, and making things less corporate, if you will. Now, this is just my own take on grunge in the late 80s, early 90s grunge movement. But it was a rejection of their parents. Now, every generation really eventually, you know, with the OK Boomer stuff that, you know, occurred 10, maybe 5 years ago, like OK Boomer, it was dismissive of the past generations. You see it in the NBA. I don't know if you follow sports. I was going to say I don't care if you follow sports, but I do. That's kind of dismissive. I don't know if you follow sports, but it happens in the NBA. Current generations dismiss previous generations. We're done with the 90s. That was, you know, Michael Jordan's era. We're done with it. We want to, you know, Steph and KD and all the, and Anthony Edwards are, they're way better. They're way more athletic. Whether or not that's true, I'm not going to get into that. That's not the point. It's just the children eventually, sooner or later, shun their parents because they have to, and that goes for generations as well. It goes back to the pendulum idea. It could be microcosmic pendulum in a house. Maybe a kid is really good, and then eventually they grow and they turn, on the parents. And maybe you've seen this growing up with your peers. Maybe you've done it yourself. Maybe you're a parent and that's being done to you. And it also happens in macro levels, like with the grunge movement. It was a rejection of this glitzy glam rock with these stylized hair bands and these big costumes and these wavy, glittery, glamorous vests and, you know, makeup. And oh my gosh, you know, think Kiss. Think, well, Motley Crue was actually like a little bit grittier than these guys, but think like David Bowie, even a Mike.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Michael Jackson, to an extent, was a part of this. He was bigger than anyone else. But Kiss. Think like even someone like Metallica or Guns N' Roses. They were not grunge. They were like a pop rock, pseudo metal. A lot of people and music aficionados that love like classic rock or hard rock are gonna tear me apart for that. But I'm just giving you my simple take. So Nirvana was a part of that movement, and they were one of the best to come out of that movement. And quickly they climbed. I'm not going to give you the history of them. What I want to get is to their idea of artistic freedom. Because when we look at grunge, it's not just a reaction to a past generation. And nor is it only a rejection of a previous musical generation. It was actually... Because it was more than that. I would be reductive if I were to say it's just a rejection. It was gritty. I mean, the word, the genre itself is called grunge. And nowadays, you can use an adjective like grungy. Think about it for one sec. I'm just going to have you think. Sorry. I'm just going to have you think for one sec. Grungy. What does that mean to you? What does that look like to you? Is there a picture in your head when I say the word grungy? When you even read the word grungy in a book, say it just appears in this paragraph? You know, some gentleman comes to town wearing this, you know, worn leather top hat with grungy hair, or just a grungy outfit, whatever. What comes to mind? It's probably something that's not stylized. It's probably something that's looks downtrodden or maybe dismissive, maybe rebellious, maybe even probably dirty, probably relatively dirty, and that's where Nirvana was going, and that's where they were taking things. That's what they were about as part of the movement. And I say all that to put this into context. When you are not only rejecting a prior generation of music, and your output is a reaction, is the reaction, but your rejection is in the form of salty, angry, visceral, guttural, literally grungy affect. We're talking about consistent white noise, like static. We're talking about like, I don't care what we wear. I don't care. In fact, not only that, I'm going to be showy about not caring what I wear. I'm going to go to the thrift shop 5 minutes before a show and pick out the second or third shirt that I see. Maybe the first one, just to spite you all. And you're not even going to know it. I barely even know what I'm wearing. And of course, there were drugs in the 60s and 70s. We all know that. But, you know, drugs then too. Unfortunately, Kurt Cobain had a lot of issues with addiction, allegedly, or I believe actually documented had bipolar. But for the topic of today, the whole point of all this context is this, folks. It's this. If you're going to have your whole image centered around the music strictly and say, if there is a spectacle to us, it's that there is no spectacle. There is no sheen in front of us. I'm going to say shut up to interviewers. I'm going to say shut up to whoever. I'm going to storm out. I'm going to smash things. I'm going to just show who I am. I'm going to say really vulgar, dirty stuff. I'm not calling Nirvana or grunge bands bad people, but like, they were grungy. Take that for what you want. They were grungy. Do you see what I'm saying? So how can you be grunge or even punkish in terms of music or even just the essence of punk? I know those are two different things. Once again, music heads, don't kill me, please, please. I'm more of a hip hop guy, although I love Nirvana as well. All sorts of stuff, but really, hip hop's kind of my wheelhouse. If you want to be punk, if you want to be like post glam rock, grunge, kind of that garage band aesthetic, how are you going to do that effectively and be truly authentic? Because that's what was a lot of the defining factors of grunge is authenticity, and oftentimes it came off as negativity or anger or rage. Harkening to Rage Against the Machine real quick. Whoop, Rage Against the Machine. Quick shout out. Love them too. But that was how, if you are under corporate control, and yes, especially definitely in the early 90s, there was no internet huge platform where you could put your music on and be seen by millions to even maybe billions of people. It didn't exist in the early 90s. I'm not saying the internet didn't exist. I'm saying you didn't have platforms. You didn't have Spotify and things like we have today. You didn't have YouTube. You didn't have SoundCloud. You had to go through a record label and get discovered somehow by a big wig with big pockets who was probably exploitative in how they got there. Once again, I'm saying probably. I'm not saying every record label exec is exploitative, but come on now. let's look at what Nirvana did when they were rising to fame and stardom, when they were catching their wind, if you will, when the wind was hitting their sails, if you will. And you know, you couldn't go indie. They were already signed to some record label. They made the album Bleach, their debut album Bleach, for about around $600. This is well documented. Then they went on to go, and there were actually two record labels, one of them very large, the other still formidable, bidding on them. I wouldn't call it a bidding war. I wasn't there, and it just kind of sounded like they had two offers, and then it was like, okay, take it or leave it, kids, you know? Because record labels are a little bit like venture capitalists, where they know all their little baby turtles are not getting to the ocean. They know most aren't. So they're like, you know what? You're unique. You're different. Here's some money, and now we own you, but make music for us. They had two big offers. One of them was from Geffen Records for around $287,000-ish. Not inflation adjusted, just at the time, around $287,000. So over $250,000 offer from Geffen Records. And they had $1 million offer from Capitol Records. Which one did they choose? Well, if I tell you in a vacuum, just that, which one do you think they chose? Then if I told you they chose Geffen Records, they chose to sign with Geffen, they spat in Capitol Records' face, not literally, well, maybe literally. They did have Kurt Cobain. He would do some stuff, and he actually vomited quite often. But they spit in Capitol Records' face, and they said, we're going with Geffen. Why? Geffen is almost... it's almost 25% of what Capitol Records was offering them. It was for full creative control. As in, Nirvana signing with Geffen Records maintained full artistic control. Hear me clearly. Hear me clearly. I'm not going to go into the specificities of the actual deal itself. I don't know who owns the freaking, you know, masters to the music now. I don't know who owned it then. I do know that Nirvana, the band, made a lot of money while Kurt was alive. I know Dave Grohl is still doing quite well, and he went on to, I believe, the Foo Fighters. Please don't kill me if I'm wrong. Capitol Records was going to shape their image. Geffen Records said, record with us. We'll pay you this. We know it's not even a third of what they're offering you. And we're talking life-changing money. If we adjust that for, you know, like late 80s, early 90s money to nowadays, for inflation, boy, that's life-changing money if you don't have a lot to begin with. And I don't think those guys did. And it was three of them. But they wanted full creative control. And I'm going to read you a quote. And I just want you to remember and think when I read you this quote. Whether or not you know Nirvana, you've probably heard of them. Think about if you truly love Nirvana. If you're like, if you love grunge and or metal or hard rock and you're a big Nirvana fan, if you've barely heard of them, there's a reason why you've even heard of them. Even if you hate their music and have heard of them, there's a reason why you've heard of them. They were massively successful and they have a cult following to this day. No, they obviously can't tour due to very sad reasons, but they are of legendary, mythical, monolithic status, up there with maybe the top 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 rock bands of all time. And folks, there have been a lot of rock bands. And I'm not just talking about top 50 commercial success. I'm talking top 30, 40, 50 in terms of just impact, in terms of how many people they've inspired and influenced. They're influencing this podcast right now. I know it's a little meta commentary, but like, just think about the impact, the name, the cover of their album. If you've never listened to one of their songs, you know Smells Like Teen Spirit. Come on, you know when those first few notes start playing on the guitar in pure from Pure Silence. Everyone knows the riff, guys. They didn't get that because they said, okay, record label exec, we're going to choose exactly who you want to produce us. We're going to, you know, you can, we're going to turn you in all the lyrics before we sing them, and you're going to have full, you know, you get to approve the album. And if we say anything you don't like, and if we step out of line, don't worry, you paid us $1 million, so we'll be happy. Nope. They said they sacrificed almost $700,000 in the interim to make what they wanted, to make what the hell they wanted, because what they wanted was national distribution and a means of making the best art possible. And of course, a record label got you both with Geffen. Geffen was big enough. They could nationally distribute them, and they had the producers, the means, the studios, and all else to get them there. Nirvana just needed to show up, and they needed to practice and just use their heart and soul and just be the artists that they were. And that's all they wanted to do. It was bigger than the money. Does that mean that they were like, no, you know, you don't even have to pay us, just distribute us? No, of course not. I told you last episode, like, I've kept saying the word cash grab. That's a negatively connotated thing. Like, maybe every job you take is a cash grab, no matter how small paying or how, you know, large and looming in salary it is. That might be a cash grab. I don't know. It's subjective. They still took the money. They took the $287 before tax. Let me read a quote after they signed with Geffen Records from Mr. Kurt Cobain himself. The long-haired, blonde-haired man who sold the world. Just kind of, that was one of their songs. He said, quote, we have one of the best contracts. Oh, and by the way, I'm going to stop you right there. This is after turning down. Essentially, they were turning down almost three-quarters of $1 million. That's $750,000. In the early 90s. So probably double that. I'm really, really, really rough at math, but probably double that. They turned down over $750,000. And Kurt Cobain immediately reacted with, quote, we have one of the best contracts any band has ever had. Huh? We have complete control over what we do. If we handed in a 60-minute tape of us defecating, Geffen, as in their label, would have to release and promote it. I'm going to read that one more time. I'm going to say a few words and then I'm going to bounce. Just think about this. Just meditate on it. We have one of the best contracts any band has ever had. We have complete control over what we do, Cobain says. If we handed in a 60-minute tape of us defecating, Geffen would have to release and promote it. They'd have to. That is the artist gaining leverage over the machine and succeeding. Not everyone's going to be a Nirvana. And if you think that everyone can be that, look at something called the Power Law, something I was introduced to around the age of 17, 18 years old. Look at something called the Power Law. It's true in entertainment, especially, but it's true everywhere. It supersedes, or basically not supersedes, it's intrinsic in nature. Not everyone's going to have the success of Nirvana, but I'm using Nirvana as one of the most salient examples of saying, F the man, but maybe we could use the man to get our words out, to get our art out. It is a little bit Basquiat-esque in that way. And oh, don't you worry, I'm going to have a Basquiat episode on this. I'm going to have a Basquiat episode and go all into it. It might even be a miniseries. But just tactically, if you are an artist or a novelist, but if you're a creator of any sort, if you're a marketer, even, like if you're a salesperson, if you, like, most people are artists and they don't realize it. Everyone is a philosopher and most don't realize it. That's a little saying that I just made up. But it stands true. Most people are artists. You do something. Do you bake? Do you cook? Now, most people that cook in the entire world don't want to commercialize it because they do something else. And they're either not good enough or not interested enough to do it. But if you say you wanted to commercialize it, you'd have to start, you know, doing the quote business side of cooking in terms of promotion, in terms of signing deals or looking for deals or talking to the right people, talking with Giada and Bobby Flay and Guy Fieri. Like, they, you know, you have to start doing the business thing of cooking, and it takes away from the cooking. What Nirvana said is, we're going to engage with you business wise. And by the way, before they signed this contract, they did a grueling, mind-bending, and from the likes of it, an awful tour in Europe where the acoustics at most venues were bad and small and cramped, and they were traveling in a van and they were all sweaty and dirty and they had equipment troubles the whole time, and they did like 36 shows in like 40-something days or 50 days. Something insane in Europe, in a foreign land. Just to make it happen, just to be able to play their art, because playing their art, here's the thing, playing their art was good enough for them. Getting the lyrics out were good enough for them. That didn't mean they weren't ambitious. You can be ambitious. Oh, I'm going to bring this back to Onyx Storm. Man, some of you are going to hate me. Does Rebecca Yarros have full creative control? And I'm genuinely asking that. I don't know. I don't know. Does Rebecca Yarros have full, and I mean full, creative control and last say over what she publishes, over what every bookstore, what Amazon sells, what every retailer sells, however it gets printed, does she have the final say? That's what I want to know. Do you ask yourself this? Do you have the final say? If not, why not? Think, this is if not a long euphemism, an extended metaphor for your own life. You probably are an artist in some way. I don't know if a lot of novelists listen to this specifically. I love studying painters and filmmakers of past and present, and all sorts of other types of artists. Or if you don't even think of yourself as an artist, you probably do something artful. Relationships can be artful. But I just want you to think of the operations and the business side and say, I'm going to utilize the crap institutions or the crap, you know, what I deem to be like the filthy parts of the world, the greedy corporations, or those guys that have the sleazy, greasy haircuts that just want to shake your hand and with the big smiles, with the big white veneers on their teeth and going and nodding at you and going, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, just, you know, using some of the systems in institutions in life that we think suck. The government, the corporations, so many institutions really like suck. I'm not saying every corporation sucks. I'm not saying everyone in government sucks. So don't take that. So don't, like I said, hear me clearly and hear me explicitly. But what I am saying is there are a whole lot of institutions. Most of them are corrupted in some way. Why not leverage them for the use of our art? Okay. Why not? Why not? Just because the means might be awful doesn't mean it actually can't add to your final product. All Nirvana wanted was national distribution and a means of production. They got both, and they turned down $750,000. That's $250,000 for each member of the band. They had three members at the time. Remember, a drummer, a bassist, and a guitarist. Just sit on it. And if I didn't, either make you think, I hope I at least entertained you and at least maybe brought up some questions in your mind for you to maybe think about later and stew on, because I love this story. I love the backdrop of it. And I think it's usable for anyone and everyone, but especially those of us that are deemed artists or that deem ourselves as artists. It's especially pertinent to that. They turned down $750,000. Oh, and by the way, if we're going to talk commercialism or their commercial impact, I'm assuming they made a whole lot more money betting on themselves with Geffen Records rather than Capitol. Just saying. Because if they didn't have the full creative control to do whatever they wanted and make whatever they wanted, including if they wanted a 60-minute tape of them defecating, they obviously didn't. They made Nevermind, which is one of the greatest rock albums of all time. Don't at me. They would have never none of it would have happened. This specific podcast episode wouldn't have happened. All those people that love Nirvana, that went to the concerts, the people got, you know, just the butterfly effect, the impact from all of it, it never would have happened, good or bad, without them saying, no, we need to play our art. If we don't, I'm just going to leave you with this, okay? This is the sign-off. If you don't have the final say in what you produce, why not? And who does? And ask yourself the important questions. Do you care? Do you care that you're a puppet? Because you're a puppet if you don't have the final say of what you produce. Yeah, yeah. That's probably the harshest thing I've said in this 37-minute episode. And I'm standing by it. In some way, shape, or form, you are a puppet. If you are paid a salary, then tell me who is the master. If you, and I'm not saying if you get a salary, that's bad. It's great. It means you got a job, you're getting income. If you don't have final say over what you produce, and it could be in any facet of life, you are in some ways a puppet. Think about freedom. I was thinking about this in terms of artistic freedom, but really freedom in general. And look at what they did with all that freedom. I'm Nick Oliveri. Thank you for listening.